Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Christoph, Internet Radio's most confusing heterosexual. Welcome to the inaugural episode of, wait, what are we talking about? This is our chance to branch out into new territory. As you know, Phoebe and I have been talking about horror history for the last eons, and today we're going to go in a completely different direction. Now we're going to talk about politics, society, culture, but not argue issues. We're here to talk about why are we arguing issues instead of discussing them. Why this harsh polarization, why this demonizing of our opponents instead of trying to find common ground and actually solve problems. Phoebe is not going to be here tonight. However, we do have our new member, Nicodemus Gunn. Say hi, Nicodemus.
Greetings. Hello. How is everybody doing tonight?
It's great to have you. You're the perfect person to help us do this, what is going to be an intro show onto sort of a semi-series you're going to see popping up here on Deviant Legion a lot recently. It's not just going to be politics. It's going to be religion, anything cultural, any kind of cultural issues that we're seeing become a battleground, which is kind of everything right now. And we also have, to help us out here in Phoebe's absence, Carl Kafer is with us.
Greetings, salutations, everyone. Nice to be here. Thanks, Christoph, for having me.
Did you bring your bicycle helmet?
No, I got my tinfoil hat.
Okay, all right. That's
appropriate.
That's perfect. Perfect for the show. All right. Well, having said that, then let's dive right in. I think. Does anybody have any introductory remarks? Okay. I'll take the dead spot.
I thought that was your deal.
Well, no, I just figured somebody else might have something they want to toss in before we get going.
Well, I mean, we're wanting to get into not the nitty gritty. Why do we disagree about things in politics? But why is it that we can't find a way to debate politics like we used to instead of arguing politics like we do now?
Right. I mean, what's at the heart of this violent disagreement we seem to be at? Because it seems like our culture has been divided very harshly into the left and the right, and it seems like both sides are just pulling harder and harder towards these extremes, and nobody wants to give any ground, nobody wants to have a discussion. It's getting ugly out there. I was listening to NPR recently, and they were talking about how right now our socio-political climate is as polarized as it has been in decades.
No, absolutely.
And then we have violence. I mean, you know, if God help you, if you're Robert De Niro or a left-wing politician, you're going to get some kind of, you know, scare device in your mail just because you voted differently.
Sorry, Nicodemus. I was just going to say.
No.
We haven't seen anything like this since the Democratic Convention in 68 and the anti-war. And I think it's actually more polarized than that, because at least at that point,
right,
we had people in the news we could trust, like Cronkite and so on and so forth, who just told us the facts. These days, you run into, you know, the pundits, and everyone has a very, very recognizable slant to their news, and there's nothing for the people in the middle trying to make sense of the yelling on the right and the yelling on the left.
Right, and especially if you're someone like me who is liberal or conservative, depending on what issue you're talking about. I don't toe a party line.
Go
ahead, Nick.
I think fundamentally, the biggest issue we have right now with the fragmentation is simply because, as much as I'm an internet guru. I love staying on the internet. That's how I maintain my information. But because of the way the internet sockets information, it is entirely possible to live in a bubble where you never see anything that compromises your worldview. And, you know, that wasn't possible 30, 40 years ago. When you watched the news, everyone had the same three channels. They got the basic facts. Now, you can get the facts that fit your worldview, and you can just pretend everything else isn't, you know, is false. It's fake news, you know.
Right. And every bias-driven, shady motherfucker with a computer can set up a free website and a Facebook account and put out just bullshit news. I mean, it's gotten difficult even for the most discerning and critical reader to, unless they're looking at what they know is a tried and true outlet, but is this real? Is this not real? Do I believe this? Do I not believe it? What do I think? You know, it's very confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways that what has happened is that, I forget who said this, but it's a wonderful pundit who said, you have the right on one side and the left on the other side of the Grand Canyon. And all the people in the middle are trying to make sense of all the noise.
Right.
And trying to figure it out. And there's no way to do that. You know, we're yelling too much and we're not listening.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, you were talking about when I was young, which is in the 70s, I was in high school and I actually debated and there were rules. And if you remember things like firing line or crossfire, there was always a chance for each person to speak their piece and then have a conversation. That's not the case now. It's yell, 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 scream, scream, you know, you're an asshole, you're this, you're that, you know. There's no sense of listening.
No, absolutely.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's all well, I forgot what I was going to say. I think part of the problem is, and I don't know why now more than before, I think back to, for example, when the Clintons were fairly divisive. I mean, still are. You know, people tend to either love them or hate them. There's not a lot of middle ground. And I remember how much conflict there was when, you know, Clinton was running for president when he was president and things like that. And same thing with Bush, very polarizing. But that all even seems mild by today's standards. It's like we're pushing towards some crisis point, and we're so overcome with this zealous idealism that we don't want to compromise. We don't want to realize that progress is based on compromise and based on meeting in the middle. You know, Buddha is spinning in his grave because his middle path has been just shunted to the side. To hell with that. You know, and I think there's nothing wrong with having political ideals, and obviously we're going to have a certain ethical or moral investment in what we believe politically, but I think we become too, for lack of a better word, religious about it. My way or the highway, if you don't agree, you're wrong, period. You're going to hell, not necessarily literally, but that mindset, you know, you're just fucking wrong.
I need to step in here, because you use the word Christian. Okay, I want to make this very clear. And actually, I'm going to be doing a show on this on December 11th, which is not this Sunday, but next Sunday. I am a Christian, but it all depends on the prism you look at it. What we see as Christian now is everything is fundamental right-wing Christian. Do you know there's a whole bunch of us who are in the middle of that, who are accepting,
mainstream Christianity?
Yeah, well, mainstream, and even if you get into the UCC and the Unitarians, you know, but I mean, the thing is, everyone is now conflating that term Christian as relating to, you know, the political end of a certain number of Christians. Okay,
I agree.
I lie at it because I always have to say to people, "Yeah, I'm a Christian, but I'm a card-carrying left, you know, left-wing,
right?
You know, Christian.
Right.
I'm not one of them. You know what? I hate doing that because I just live my life and I make my decisions the way that I look at being a Christian and how I perceive the Bible and Christ." So, you know, it bothers the shit out of me. Anyway, enough from me. Sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say, I agree with you. I said religious, not Christian, but I absolutely totally agree with you. I do agree with you. And unfortunately, that attitude, that religious attitude is very associated with Christianity because, unfortunately, the most vocal Christians also tend to be the biggest assholes because they're the ones that are most invested in trying to force their opinion on everybody else. You know, those of us that are a little more accepting we're less prone to, like, you have to think the same thing I do because we don't think that way. That's why, for example, okay, I'm on paper, I'm an Episcopalian. You know, so obviously we're a very laid back group. You know, go see Eddie Izzard's Dress to Kill show where he talks about eating cake or death from the Anglicans. You know, we're a very laid back group. We're not. You don't see us out proselytizing. We have outreach. We help people. You don't see us proselytizing so hard. Not like the Assembly of God or the Mormons or the Jehovah's Witnesses. The same thing for the Methodists. The Methodists are very much into the social gospel. They're not into the Bible-thumping gospel.
Yeah.
But those are the ones you hear.
I always feel weird because I grew up in Arkansas, but my family was completely non-religious. And that said, you know, I've got a lot of good friends who are very strongly Christian, but the liberal ones, you know, it's like I have a friend of mine who's a priest who continually reminds me that, you know, what would Jesus do? That option can include flipping over tables and beating bankers with a stick. So,
right, but what Jesus is going after is actual corruption, not theological disagreement.
You know, or talking to a Samaritan woman on a Sunday, which was forbidden by Jewish law. Okay, you know, see, that's the thing. That really is the thing because, you know, it's the prism of how we look at, you know, whether it be the Bible or politics or whatever the case would be, it's the prism, and we have to say, you know, I don't know. I don't have any knowledge. I believe there are two different things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, that brings somebody open to listening to other viewpoints, you know? You know, people... There is a thing in the Episcopal Church called the Holy Doubt, which means that we believe, but we're always, you know, we're always striving to believe more and to listen to other people because that's how you grow, that's how you communicate, that's how you come together. Now,
there is no spiritual growth without asking questions.
Right, and we live in an era of fear, and to me, Christ is love. It's the exact opposite. So you embrace people.
Gentlemen, this is your magic voice. We have a caller.
Oh,
hello,
hey
caller.
Guys.
Oh,
hey there.
I think I need no introduction. It is the famous Phoebe McGuffin here. I just wanted to call in and say that I am really sorry I'm missing this evening, especially being our inaugural show of, wait, what are we talking about? But I have been forced into a family dinner that cannot be moved. So I just...
Not a movable
No, no, it is an absolutely immovable beast. Like, I got stuck. I got yelled at by a sick and dying man this morning, so I am at the dinner now. So I just wanted to wish everybody, you know, luck and love and light and happiness, and I can't wait to listen to everything that's going on later, but they really frown at you being on your cell phone the whole time at a family dinner, so...
Well, you know what? Enjoy your sushi. Isn't that what
I am. I am at one of the finest sushi establishments in, I'm going to say, the state. It's some of the best stuff I've ever had in my life, and I've been all over the world. So, I'm actually pretty excited about that. I'm not going to lie. There's going to be a lot of pictures later, and I'm not a food poster, but you're going to want to see this. But
I can confirm
she is
correct.
Yes, you can. It is fabulous. And Nicodemus and Christoph, my two brothers in arms and in love, even though we're from another mother, I just love you both so much, and I am so happy that we're doing this together.
Likewise.
What, am I chopped liver here?
I said,
I guess I
well, Carl, I mean, you're obvious, and Doc, and everybody else. I love all of you guys, and I'm pretty sure I tell you that, like, daily, because I'm a little sentimental.
We're just more special than you are, Carl.
I just give you a hard time.
I mean, they come to my house and eat dinner with me, so there's that.
I was the guy on the couch at their house for a while.
Yeah, you were totally my Stephen Wright, and I love you for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the next time you ever have to stay on our couch, I do expect you to have learned the entirety of the Stephen Wright song, Rachel, for obvious reasons to you guys.
I used to have the album I Have a Pony, as it happens.
I do, too.
It's a good album.
So, yes. And if I could dye my hair plaid, I totally would.
You are goddamn right.
All right. Well, I love all of you, but honestly, it just got cold in Arkansas, so I'm going to go inside now.
All right. Go enjoy food.
Probably a wise idea.
I'll get the large sake and pour one for my homies that can't be here tonight.
Sweet.
All right. Well, listeners and new fans and everybody else, we love you all, and thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for calling in.
All right. You stay classy, San Diego.
Okay, Carl, as to what you were saying, Carl, I love the fact Jesus was a social reformer first and foremost. Right, he was a social reformer. Mm-hmm. Is what he was attacking when he was doing things like, chewing out religious leaders, flipping tables over in the temple. He was attacking an excess of religiosity of people who were legalistic and based on this rigorous moralistic zeal. And now the very sort of person he was condemning is the person that's holding up the stick he's nailed on and waving it around as a weapon.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's
absolutely.
It's pathetic. And I had a thought there and it just went away. Oh, well.
Those things happen, trust me.
Oh, I know, especially the older you get. But it's what I know what I was going to say. If Jesus were around today, turning tables over and things like that, do you know where that would be happening? In the fundamentalist church down on the corner. That's where it would be happening. In the churches. That's where he did it last time, it was in the temple, and today it would be in the churches. Be like, you stupid motherfuckers are missing the point. Stop it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't come to tear each other apart like this. When he predicted, I came to set mother against daughter, et cetera, et cetera. He wasn't saying I'm here to start a fight. He was saying that conflict is going to arise from my message. And boom, what happened? The world's greatest peacekeepers or peace preachers, whatever, are also some of the world's most controversial figures. Look at Gandhi, look at Buddha, look at Jesus. These are the people that have a storm of controversy around them and their ideas because people interpret them badly, and they get hung up on the surface. Go on, I've totally taken over. Go on, Carl, say something.
No. I agree. And the one thing is, it's not only that, but who did he reach out to? He reached out, how many verses are there about treating the immigrant correctly? And treating them like family and bringing them into your house, or treating the least of these. Now, I really grew of age in New York City in the early 80s. I was in my early 20s, and that was the time of AIDS. And I was in a position and in a job where a good 60 to 70% of the people I worked with and also were my customers were gay, and I went to like 20 some funerals and was pallbearer at 3, and I remember saying at the time, if Jesus came down, where the first place he would be and he'd go was in a gay bar, because those are the people, it's the least of us that we have to really be concerned about. And the thing is, we're talking about politics and we should get back to that. But I don't consider myself political. I consider myself looking through a religious prism, and that's my own prism, how I look at it, and deciding, you know, what are the right policies.
Well, now, to take this.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, to take this exactly to what you're talking about there, it's worth noting, you know, when Christoph was talking about Jesus said that, you know, his methods were going to bring conflict. That brings up an interesting question. Is the reason that we're in so much conflict now because we're needing to reassess our priorities? We've let things lay where they were for too long, and we need to find the conflict is not necessarily a problem in and of itself, but it's a symptom of the fact that we've been ignoring these questions for too long.
Right.
It's what
is known. I agree too. Go ahead, Christoph, and then I'll jump in.
Okay, I was going to say. I mean, one of the things that seems to be, even if it doesn't always come out as these, you know, the thing they say on the surface, one of the things I think we're at a crux at here, say between conservative and liberal, which again is what the huge dividing line we're facing right now. And just for context, I have a conservative streak. I have a huge libertarian streak, but I also have a compassionate side that, you know, that wants a solution for, concerns like the poor, things like that. So this one thing's where I'm in the middle ground, because I'm very socially liberal, but in some ways I'm conservative. The problem is, with a lot of conservative argument is, and I have a certain sympathy for the constitutionalist mindset, but I think this whole thing of like almost we see it's the Bible. You can't change it. This is how it was written back in the 18th century when everything was not at all exactly the same as it is now. You know, I mean, maybe, and this has been a hard conclusion for me to come to, because as I say, I've spent a lot of my life with a very, very politically conservative streak. Now I find myself at a point where I don't really care for either of the major parties, and I certainly don't believe that the Republicans truly represent conservatism. But maybe we're getting too hung up, and that's part of it. Well, this is how it is, and this is how it's always been, and it's like, well, what if that's not working anymore? Maybe we should think about changing things.
It's called a correction point.
Right.
Okay, and we have gone through, as a country, many correction points. Okay, and they are always very volatile. You go back to the Revolution, you go back to the Civil War, you go to the Indian dispensary, and all these things up until, you know, the Civil Rights Movement. Now we have a very anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim thing that is happening, and so these correction points are very volatile. I went through two of them. I actually went through three of them in my lifetime, and they're not fun. And unfortunately, you know, there's just a situation where what do we do? You know, we have to think a different way. And
growing pains
people...
are growing pains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Go on.
I agree. Go ahead.
No, that's all I have to say. I was just bouncing in there. You're saying we have to tell people.
Yeah. It's I don't want to take over this podcast. I'm a guest, but you know, it seems to me that, again, without listening to each other, without really discussing all these things and just yelling, we're at a standstill until some, you know, I mean, and that's very, very apparent with how the Republicans are treating Democrats and vice versa. So there's nothing being done. And guess what? When you do nothing, guess what happens? We elect someone like our president. I'm just saying.
I've kind of thought that it's and I'm not really saying this as a comment one or the other, but it's interesting that our political state, our mindset, our government was in the shape that someone like him would be elected. I mean, I find that interesting. Like, what is that? Now, I'm not talking about what this says about the president. What does this say about our political condition that such a president was possible? And I'm not saying I'm a Trump supporter or a Trump hater, either one. I think he has done good things, but I also done a few things I'm kind of like about. You know, it's where were we at if he could be elected? Jump in.
I have to take a hard line there and say I cannot in any way get behind Trump, and I will freely admit to being that guy. And part of it is because I think even with my disagreements with the Conservative Party, the issues with them tended to be one where I thought, okay, they're wrong with their prescription, but they have, you know, some basic, you know, moral compass. And
right.
I have some serious – I have serious problems believing – that Donald Trump wants anything other than for people to pay attention to him, and that may make for an entertaining reality TV show, but it makes for a completely horrific political system.
Right. I'm basically falling into the don't like Trump camp. I'm not willing to say that every single thing he does is completely wrong. Honestly, nothing good has happened. However, I think a lot better people could have accomplished some of the same good that he has accomplished without a lot of the bullshit. You know, and for me, anything about his character. I find his character extremely questionable. But anyway, I wasn't trying to get off on those issues. And by the way, while I'm thinking about it, this podcast right here today is a good example of the kind of discussion and the kind of mindset that we could have, because people here represent very diverse political views. Just the three of us in this conversation represent some, there's some overlap, but there's a very sharp divergence of opinion. One of the first times I met Nicodemus, you know, he and I was basically like, oh, I'm basically libertarian. He's like, I'm a social democrat. And what followed was a very pleasant, congenial discussion, and he and I hit it off. Now, why doesn't that happen more?
Well, I think people just don't know how to do it. I mean, again, I go back to my training in debate, and one of the people that we really looked at was William F. Buckley, who I disagreed with tremendously, but my God, did I respect him. You know, and it's,
people seem
and
to
it's
forgotten
that decorum. It's that sense. You know, I mean, his arguments with Gore Vidal got pretty damn heated. But nonetheless, I mean, we studied him, and to go back what you were saying previously, I try to do a prism, not politically, but through my, you know, beliefs in religion and what Jesus represents to me.
Right,
but
right.
The other thing, too, is as far as Trump, there are good things that have happened.
Yes.
I think the music tax thing that he came up with, the copyright revisions were incredibly well.
To help ensure that artists got
also
better compensation for their work.
Toward, he's working toward getting prescriptions down and working against pharma, which I also think is a very good thing. So, you know, there's always, no matter what, you know, the divide is, you know, there's always some point of connection. And
right.
Though the three of us have separate views, to really make this work, we would need a real Trump supporter on here and be able to talk.
Right.
Okay. And hopefully we can do that. You know,
oh, yeah.
That we can have civilized conversation and try to bridge gaps, because that's what we need to do.
Well, and as I said, this show is today's show, which, by the way, listeners, is going to run a little shorter than our usual 2 hours, but this show is an introduction to a theme you're going to see recur, not just with our show, but with some of the other shows in Deviant Leaf. It's going to come back. We're not done talking about this. You know, like I said, today we're just kind of looking at the the polarization thing. And what you're talking about, Carl, that's kind of the problem. It's not an all or nothing thing. It's not black and white. But that's the problem. And plus, again, you were saying you don't consider yourself a political person. You consider your political views as shaped by your religious views. Our political views really shouldn't be the crux or the core of our views. Our political views should be something that is shaped by what is our core views, whatever those are. Our core moral compass should not be identical to our political compass.
Right. You know, and just to make it clear, I'm very much for the separation of church and state. I would also be okay with taxing churches.
Oh, I would
be fine with that.
I would too. I mean, you have the same tax breaks as anybody. You do whatever charitable stuff you do, put it on your taxes, take a deduction on that. But stuff for running your own facilities is not charitable. Pay for it like everybody else.
I think the biggest, I said the, to me, the biggest, most important point that lets us have this argument, though, is that while all of us may have different perspectives on why different things should change, why different policies are good or bad, we all agree on a basic set of facts, you know.
Right.
And I think that to me is the hardest thing to deal with the point where debate becomes arguing is where, you know, where we're having to argue whether or not water is wet.
Right.
And
right.
there are people who will argue that because Donald Trump says that, you know, that there are lots of Middle Eastern terrorists running up here from Guatemala because that's where Middle Eastern terrorists come from.
Right. Well, and that's a good example of people are bending the facts to fit their political ideal because their political ideal seems to be their central motivating thing. It's like, what are your political ethics based on? I mean, it seems like a vicious circle if your political ethics are based on your political ethics. I mean, that's kind of an abstract way to put it, but, you know, the best I can come up with on short notice is like, what are your ethics based on? Your politics should be one of the spokes coming out of that, not the... It shouldn't be the hub. It should be a spoke.
Okay, so I want to go back a little bit here. Okay, when I grew up, okay, yeah, Walter Cronkite, you had all these people out there, David Franklin, and they gave you what was considered facts. What has happened now was news outlets, and I touched on this earlier, but none of it is fact anymore. There's so much opinion, and then so much proliferation of false narratives out there, just like the bombs that were sent, you know, to the Democrats. You know, oh, it could be a false flag. Oh, bullshit. You just say bombs were sent. That's all you need to say. Okay? Don't say anything else, because just give me the fucking facts.
Right, you veer into speculation, you're veering into political commentary, and if you have a political commentary show, fine, keep it to the political commentary show. Keep it to the opinion column, not the news article, the news show. And it's so – this is coming from someone that spent 10 years in journalism too. I spent 10 years in journalism, so, I mean, I understand journalistic ethics. And it's the way – just the phrase you use, you can state a fact – but depending on the particular term you use to refer to a particular thing, you can put spin on it. You don't even have to say your opinion. You don't have to speculate. Just the chosen term for a thing can be loaded. And I see news using loaded terms. And also, you can it's what part of the story do you present? Because there's always a bigger story than the one that's being presented. There's always more. What's the context that you're creating for the story? You know, there's so many subtle and insidious ways that you can bend the news to your favor. And there was a time, and it seems like maybe that's not so much anymore, there was a time when the utmost ethic or the utmost ethics for a journalist, TV, print media, whatever, was to present the facts as neutrally as possible and keep your own goddamn opinion out of it unless it's an opinion piece.
Right.
And if you can't verify your facts, if you can't back it up, if you haven't been able to fact check what you're saying, don't say it.
You know, I mean, long gone is the era of Edward Murrow.
Right.
Who was the king of that, you know, and also defended himself against McCarthy. We don't have anyone like that.
No,
not even close.
Nope.
Not even close.
Nope.
You know, and you talk about ethics. You know, news is no longer news. It's entertainment. And it's false flags and that, you know. I mean, I believe that both the political end of this and the news reporting end of this is at fault. They both have responsibility here for this.
Well, then I will put on my socialist hat here and say a lot of that problem is because news has been commercialized. It used to be news was what they called a loss leader on television. You did the news because that was your public duty, and you made money off the other stuff you showed on TV. And now I've worked in the newsroom. I've got a journalism degree, and you would be given stories, and the question on the story was not, is this an important story? It was, how can we market this? How can we make this, make money for the newsroom?
Sure. And sell papers.
When you're more worried about how you're going to make money off of it than whether or not you're presenting news, then you lose something.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that kind of makes an argument for systems like Britain has with the BBC, you know, where it's publicly funded.
Absolutely. And it's one of the reasons I get most of my news from NPR.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I listen to NPR all the time. As I said, I've got a huge conservative streak. I still listen to NPR all the time because I'm a critical thinker. I can decide what I agree with and don't agree with and at least feel like I'm not, you know. And I mean, I do think with NPR, you can tell that people do it are generally of a more liberal persuasion, but I don't feel like I'm listening to Fox News. You know?
Yeah.
There's a mean about it. And for that matter, I mean, maybe – you know, maybe something like NPR only feels liberal to people who have who are very right of center. You know, I mean, because like I said, I've been going through this thing here lately, and I plan to talk about this more on another podcast, where I decided to deliberately be open-minded, question a lot of my conservative values, decide which ones are really mine and which ones are just this ego-based idealism. Because ego is a big problem here, too, you know. Because one of the arguments, really, if you want to – I mean, this is very – broad way to put it, is, you know, don't take this too much more than a grain of salt, but you can generally say that the classic conservative mindset is rooted in individualism, whereas the socialist mindset is rooted more in collectivism. So an individualist mindset is going to be more ego-driven by definition. It's going to be egoist. I'm not egotist, egoist. Now, obviously, egotism can come from that, but it's going to be very egoist. So I had to ask myself the questions, how much of this is really a legitimate ethic that I hold, and how much of this is just my own ego saying, oh, well, fuck them. You know, and so I started deliberately listening to ideas outside what I thought I believed, and I'm finding myself, I'm still adjusting to this. I'm still a little, it's weird to be here because, I mean, when you really make the effort to question what you believe, which again, this comes back to what, in religious terms, which you talked about the doubt earlier, it applies to politics too. You know, I'm finding myself a little more centrist than I thought I was. And so I have to think, well, maybe if something does strike me as liberal, first of all, I don't automatically think, oh, it's a dirty word. Liberal, you know, I don't vilify it just because it's different. I'm also wondering, well, how much of that's because I'm still coming from a place that tends to be very right at center. So much of that's my own perspective. You know, people forget that your viewpoint is not identical to the objective viewpoint.
It never is.
No, it's not. Mm-hmm. And I think most people I think most people lack the self-awareness to really honestly question themselves like that. And it is challenging and it's scary because you're deliberately holding things up that views you have valued perhaps very strongly, and you're holding them up for question. That's frightening, be it religion, politics, whatever.
Well, and I don't know how familiar you guys are with the concept of the Overton window, but that's another thing that I think contribute something to that, which is, in a lot of ways, the overall political character, I guess, of America has gotten much more, has gone much more to the right over the last 30, 40 years, because this is to the credit of the conservatives. Conservatives tend to be, we want this, we only want this, we won't accept anything other than this. And liberals, progressives, whatever you want to call them, tend to be more willing to compromise because we tend to be made up of smaller constituencies, you know, that are working together. And so the fact that, you know, if you constantly compromise with somebody who isn't willing to compromise, you slowly move towards them. And
right.
So I think that has been a failing, I think, of the political left in much of America the last 30, 40 years, is that I think we've compromised away a lot of the ground that we would be arguing over.
Well, I think that failing goes both ways, too, because, I mean, on the one hand, yes, maybe the left could have stood a little harder before now, because now suddenly we're finding that, you know, we see extremes on both sides, but there's obviously very extreme left-wing stuff happening too, and it's not too far from the mainstream. But at the same time, I think that's kind of an overreaction. You know, there's always the equal and opposite reaction thing. I think the left is suddenly like, wait a minute, no. So it's because maybe it's waited so long to stand up, it's taking a harder stance than perhaps it would have otherwise, because it's reacting to, you know, some of the equally extreme things that you see happening on the right. But as far as the failing going both ways, I mean, yes, perhaps maybe the left was too willing to compromise, but at the same time, maybe the right should have been more willing to compromise.
Gentlemen, we have a call.
To me, it's the heart of the problem. Okay?
Hi, my name is Benny.
Hi, caller.
Hello, your name is?
I'm Becky.
Hi, Becky.
Hi, Becky.
Hello, Becky.
What do you have to say? What are your thoughts?
First, I'd like to know what the topic is.
Broadly speaking, why are we so divided right now? Why is it just a bunch of arguing and hate, and each side just, you know, there's no middle ground, there's no compromise in the world of sociopolitics. You know, for example, and I'm not trying to say this is a specific subject, but for example, everyone either hates Trump or they love Trump. Where's the middle ground? Everyone either hates socialism or they love socialism. Where's the middle ground? You know,
the middle ground, I believe,
yeah.
We only have two parties, yet there are four different parties that we should vote on. We should be able to vote for more than just two parties. They should be more known.
I do too. The British Parliament system
mm-hmm.
is fantastic because there's not just two major parties; there's multiple major parties, and we have, you know, we have other parties here. But as Becky's pointing out, they're relatively minuscule. They're not going to win in most cases. Sorry, go on.
I think we're unanimous in our love of the British parliamentary system.
Yeah, it would be great. That'd be fantastic. That's a fantastic point, Becky.
Unfortunately, the way that it's working is that the government and the two-party system, that's the one thing they work toward with each other, is to block the real advance of these smaller parties. I mean, if you listen to us, you know, I tend to be libertarian in certain ways. Certainly Christoph is. But there's no viable libertarian candidate. There never will be, the way
right.
that it's set up now.
Right.
And that's unfortunate. And I agree with you, Becky.
Yeah, she's absolutely right. The last time we voted,
it was voting for the lesser of the two evils, basically.
Oh, it's been on forever.
In my opinion.
You're right.
Well,
The
horrible part about that is from the point of view of the two major parties, that's a bug and not a feature. I mean, that's a feature and not a bug. The political system in America is built so that if you're not a Democrat or a Republican, it's incredibly hard to even get on the ballot. And so they've built that in to protect themselves.
They're entrenched. No, it's no different than a cabal among businesses. It's like, well, we've got this sewn up, and we might be competitors and hate each other, but we can at least agree on this. We're not going to let anybody else come play our game of Monopoly. Not seriously have a chance
now,
of winning.
I will say there are some people out there doing some really brilliant things to break that system. Once again, showing my leftist roots, Ocasio-Cortez is a Democratic Socialist, but she's running as a Democrat because the Democratic Socialists have decided as a party that they're better off not being a party in the sense of a Democrat or Republican. They're essentially branding themselves as a party within a party. They're essentially a sort of a caucus within the Democratic Party. And so by doing
Which
that, they're able to sort of co-opt that ability to run as a Democrat.
And that also provides them the opportunity to grow into an entity of their own. If they get enough support and get enough movement, they could theoretically could potentially break away and be their own party once they – it's sort of like launching a shuttle. When it launches, it's got that whole extra thing that pulls it up there, and then when that's done, it dumps it. Well, a third party, a successful third party, could be the shuttle with the Democratic Party or the Republican Party being, you know, the engine that launches it up there. And then when it's done, when it's got its momentum, it can jettison that, and then it's its own thing.
Honestly, I think the Libertarians would do well to do the same thing with the Republican Party.
I agree. I think you're right. It's kind of a damn if you do, damn if you don't, because on the one hand, if you stay Libertarian...
The problem is with that, guys, is what has happened is you have the Tea Party, which is a faux Libertarian. There's no real Libertarian out there. And so the Libertarian, you know, Tea Party is considered the Libertarian caucus. And it's not even libertarian.
Well, it was when it first got started, but it's been co-opted by the lunatic fringe. Mm-hmm. It didn't start off as lunatic as it is now, but it got that way. Because, again, the lunatic fringe, who are going to disagree with the mainstream, they're going to glom on to anything like that. And as I was saying, it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't, because you can either just start off as an independent third party and not, you know, have the taint of one of the two major parties, but you're not going to get anywhere. Or you can work within the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, but then you're working within the entity that you're trying not to be.
And
when you get on the fringe like that. Right. And when you get on the fringe, you have, for example, we're talking about the Libertarians, you've got the Libertarian Party. Then within the Republican Party, you've got the Tea Party. Or you've got the Constitutionalists. And these are all people that are essentially in the same neck of the woods, but they're so divided up. You know, and there's even that lack of unification on one side of the spectrum. And for example, I mean that's what Trump has done with the Republican Party. There's a lot of division of the conservatives. There's a lot of them love him, a lot of them fucking hate him. You know.
Yeah. I can't understand why certain people can't take a look at our president and say, well, he's so divisive. And he's this and he's that. And I'm not even going to say, you know, the words, you know, he's racist or whatever the case would be.
Right.
And, like, stand up against him and say no. Is it so power-driven? Are we so power-driven and power-hungry that we let someone like that take over and shape the country? Really?
To me, it's kind of like, I think people, there's such a, go on, yeah.
I was going to say, in a lot of ways, I think part of that is the phenomena of, well, as much as Trump maybe is not what most Republicans would see their party as, the fact of the matter is that there's a hardcore base in the Republican Party that is perfectly happy to let him, you know, run his crazy stunts. Because essentially at this point, the Republicans in Congress have figured out that they can pass any bill they want, and he'll sign it because he likes to sign bills. You know, it's a deal with the devil is essentially what
mm-hmm.
it is. But I firmly believe it's going to come back to bite them in the ass. But in the meantime,
like everybody else,
I think that there's at least a constituency in the Republican Party that wants him there because to borrow a phrase from I believe it was Stalin who coined the term useful idiot.
Right. I was going to say it's pragmatism, isn't it? It's not a very good pragmatism, yeah. But it's pragmatism. It's like, well, he's beneficial in a very practical way. To hell with ethics or actually getting anything done. He's beneficial in a very practical ways. Even a lot of people don't like him. They see the benefit because for whatever reason, he has a lot of support, and what he's doing for conservatives seems to work in terms of getting people together, getting people lined up on his side, getting people fighting mad to, vote Republican. Though, I mean, his spurring people on is going to get Republican voters, even if they're voting for a Republican who might not agree with Trump, it's getting Republican voters. And that, power-wise, that's where Trump is right now.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to go back a little bit here, okay? Because we were talking about religion earlier in the podcast, and I just want to make this point. I take a look at it, again, from a religious viewpoint, and I go to Revelations, and two words come up, false prophets. False prophet.
Interesting.
You know, and that the fundamental right-wing Christian churches have latched onto a false prophet, and I am very, very unnerved by that.
There's a whole group out there. There's this whole movement of people that actually believe that he is divinely, really, literally, he's a divinely appointed prophet. God sent him.
Okay,
God chose him to be president.
So that brings something up. So on the 11th, again, we're going to have a podcast with my friend Pastor Joel. And Pastor Joel is a UCC pastor, very, very liberal. And we're going to be discussing some religious movies, but one particular that just came out, and I don't have the title of it in front of me, was produced by Liberty University. And it actually showed in movie theaters basically saying that God is appointed, I mean, that Trump is appointed by God. Okay, that scares the living shit out of me.
Oh my God!
I am not joking.
I believe you. This is a good example of unholy dovetailing of religion and politics.
I believe in the separation. Okay, religion is personal. Okay,
agreed.
It's how you treat people and how you look at the world through your personal sphere and prism. You shouldn't do laws by it because you know what? Other people don't believe the way you do.
Well, and I know this is something you're easily misinterpreted. I'm not a nationalist. I'm sorry. I don't really think in those. I don't hold the U.S. up the same. Politics has become a religion. It's like, instead of a Bible on the altar, it's the American flag. Instead of the priest, it's the government representatives or the president. He's the grand poobah. It's become a religion, and that's frightening. That's not the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And really, the government is supposed to be more practical, getting things done while still respecting. It is a balancing act. And that's where everyone seems to have forgotten that it's a balancing act. I mean, the whole system we have is set up to be checks and balances to make sure it doesn't tip to one extreme or the other. In fact, I was listening to NPR, and they were talking about, how do we get to arrive at this number? For example, was it 435 people in Congress? When did the cap? They talked about the cap being put on that in the early 20th century. They said, hey, we're getting too many people. And maybe that worked at the time, but populations continued to grow. Which means a number that worked at the time may not work so much now because there's going to be more imbalance if we're not able to go back. Maybe we should think about this. Or the case of Supreme Court justices. I've heard some very compelling arguments that maybe they shouldn't be life nominees. Maybe there should be a term limit on those too.
Well, this goes to another.
Go ahead.
This goes to another sort of pet project of mine, which is I think we have not done enough. I don't think we've changed the Constitution enough. I think there's a cult in America that sort of believes the Constitution was this one perfect document that, you know, can't
right.
ever be changed. But I think
it's
right.
Bible.
To me, the four most important words in the Constitution are right at the very beginning, where it calls for a more perfect union. And if you think about
mm-hmm.
that, what it's saying is this isn't a perfect union. It's never going to be perfect. You're constantly working to make it better. There's going to be change. I think it was Thomas
mm-hmm.
Jefferson at one point argued that the Constitution should basically expire every generation and have to be renegotiated.
Yeah, that's my favorite president
well,
right there.
Well, you know, one of the things there, Nicodemus, is, and you take a look at the Bible too. When I was in school for my master's, the Bible is considered a living document. It's a living document. It's alive, and the reason it's alive is that each person gleans a certain perspective out of it. Okay, this is true also of the Constitution, I believe, that it
mm-hmm.
is a living document, and therefore it needs to be reassessed. And as we grow and as we change, we need to make sure that that's reflected within the document.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the Constitution should be seen as inviolable. I mean, there wouldn't be a process for amending the Constitution if it wasn't supposed to grow and adapt. I mean, we've had some occasional amendments that were pretty useful, like, oh, I don't know, freeing slaves, things like that, you know.
You know, giving women the vote. Yeah.
Deciding that white men were not the only people that get to be called people.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah, that's the whole point. And it's just like the Bible. You mentioned the Bible. One thing that's interesting, one of the coolest Bibles out there is the Revised Standard Version, or the New Revised Standard Version of the Oxford Annotated Bible. First of all, it has the most complete Apocrypha. Its Apocrypha is bigger than the Roman Catholic, the quote-unquote extra books, the deuterocanonical books. I like that term better, the made canon later. And there's a thing in there, it's divided up into sections. So it's like, well, these are the books, here's the Apocrypha, so the Protestants don't accept any of this stuff as scripture. Well, Episcopalians sort of do, they're scripture, but not for, you know, not for basic doctrine on. And then it says, okay, well, this section, this is the ones Roman Catholics include in their Bible. Well, now, these are ones that only the Orthodox Church includes in its Bible. Well, there's even a little section at the back, a handful of books, that only a little cluster of Coptic churches, which they're part of the Orthodox communion, that only they include. And there are actually, there's a very small group, but there's a few little churches in Africa, some of the Coptic churches, that don't have a rigid sense of canon like you find in most churches. You know, most churches, like, these are the books. If you're Protestant, these are the 66 books of the Bible. If you're Catholic, I don't remember what the number is, but these are X number of books of the Bible. This is the list. This is it. This is definitive. No more, no less. But there is that little group of churches, they don't have that. They're, you know, they accept the core books that all branches of Christianity accept. But at the fringes, it gets more floaty. It kind of depends on maybe what mood they're in, you know, that decade, or which church you're at. It's not so hardly defined. I like that because it's like, well, this speaks to me that way. I see God talking to me through this book, so why the hell isn't it canon? You know, and as like I said, on paper, technically, officially, I'm a Christian, but I have gotten just as much spiritual nourishment from studying the philosophy of Buddhism. And let me tell you, my favorite sacred text is not the Bible. My favorite sacred text is the Bhagavad Gita, because it has spoken to me. So you certainly can't accuse me of having a rigid sense of what's canon or what's sacred writ.
Well, mm-hmm. just to add to that, I have two books on my nightstand here, and one of them is the Bible. And the other one is The Exegesis by Philip K. Dick, who is a Gnostic.
There's some heady stuff in there.
Yeah.
There's some heady stuff in there.
So, you know, I mean, the thing is, always be open. You never know
mm-hmm.
what's going to speak to you. If you close yourself off and you have a rigid sense of this is what I believe and nothing else, then you're never going to grow.
Right, you're going to suffer as much as anybody does.
And you're going to shrivel up like the seed that's thrown in the rocks.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yep, and there's a good example of, reading between the lines in the Bible, or the Bible being a living document, because you have your very cut-and-dry VBS, standard Sunday morning sermon interpretations of the Bible, but the things I find most interesting is when something comes at me from an angle, like, I didn't think about that. That's interesting, and it's totally beyond the normal context. And as far as the original meaning of the Bible, I mean, there are so many what are now traditional, conventional, accepted interpretations that would have been absolutely foreign to the original biblical writers, who, by the way, in most cases are not what the Bible says. Moses didn't write the Pentateuch. Matthew didn't write Matthew. You know, the only one that actually wrote what it says he wrote was Paul, and that's only about half of the stuff attributed to him. Anyway, point being, look at eschatology. Look at the Book of Revelation, the Book of Daniel. Look at shitty Kirk Cameron movies, and not quite as shitty Nicolas Cage remakes of Kirk Cameron films, and ungodly series of books that Tim LaHaye may got rich on. Those interpretations of apocalyptic literature would be mind-boggling to John of Patmos, to whoever wrote the Book of Daniel. It wasn't Daniel. They would be blown away.
By the way, I just need to add this.
Yes.
That we actually did a Christmas watch of a shitty Kirk Cameron movie called Saving Christmas, and I got yelled at because I kept screaming at how horrible the the theology was in it.
Well, it's awful. But, I mean, and again, I know this is sort of off topic, but it's sort of not, because we're talking about us hugging these conventional ideas and being unwilling to question them. But the apocalyptic books are really very, very simple to understand. It's in the case of the Book of Daniel, it was writing about Antiochus Epiphanes, who came in, sacked the temple, defiled it, and basically just wrought blasphemy. And in the case of the Book of Revelation, it was once again Rome. They came in, fucked the Jews up, because Revelation was written toward the end of the first century, and it was written during the reign of Emperor Diocletian, who was not Christian friendly at all. So all that imagery, all it boils down to is the big scary monster is the government persecuting you right now. Yes, people are dying, but in the end, good wins. It's not difficult, but we turn it into these elaborate theologies that we then hang our, our souls on. If you disagree with my theology, then you're going to burn, and that gets us back to the same mindset we've applied to our politics, especially since we seem to have merged our politics and our religion to a point that they're inseparable.
Right. Well, and a big part of that, and it goes to what you're talking about there, is a lot of people who seem to be both religious and conservative, a lot of the reason that their religion is so skewed is because they are specifically using their religion essentially as a club. They're saying, hey, mm-hmm. I found these three texts in my religion that say this exact thing that I want them to say, and that's my cudgel to use against you, that, hey, you should do what I tell you to or you're going to hell. Yeah.
Right.
And
okay.
So it's classical cherry picking. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. So I want to make a point here. I cherry pick too. Okay? I cherry pick too. Everybody cherry picks. Trust me. Okay, the point is that some of us understand the difference between
mm-hmm.
knowing and believing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And some of us are open to listen. Again, when we started this particular thing, podcast, I mentioned about we don't listen anymore. Okay?
No.
And if something closes your mind off that much, okay, that you won't listen to anyone else, it's not good for you. As far as I'm concerned.
Oh, I misinterpreted what you meant. I'm sorry. I thought you meant some things closing off two of opposite viewpoints. I get what you're saying. What I was saying, but I thought you were saying, what I'm saying is, if something challenges you that much, you don't want to listen to it, maybe you should. It doesn't mean you have to agree with it, but it means you can learn from it, and maybe if you do end up staying where you already believe, at least you will have considered the other side, and your belief will be strengthened thereby.
Excuse me, Glenn, we have another caller.
Okay.
Hello, Carl. Hello, Carl. Caller 612. State your name, please.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. My name is David.
David, nice
Hello.
To have you with us.
Good evening.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, guys.
What do you got to say, man?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask, and I'm just tuning in, so I'm not quite sure, but politically, would you guys consider yourself to the left or to the right or more down the center?
Depends on who you ask. Yeah, you probably missed the thing we were talking about earlier. Nicodemus identifies as a social democrat. I generally identify as a libertarian. And Carl, what would you say you identify as? Basically libertarian, classic liberal?
I would say libertarian, but fiscally I tend to be on the responsible side.
Right.
But on the other side, on more social issues, I'm definitely much more toward the Democrats. I view it more from a sort of a mainstream Christian perspective too, as I said before. So,
right. Well, I should clarify, but as libertarian, I'm including very much the idea, you know, that government non-intervention means it stays out of issues like gay rights and transgender things like that. It lets people be who they are. I'm very socially liberal, so I guess I'm socially liberal. I have a strong fiscally conservative streak, but I also have a more left leaning when it comes to some social programs. Oh, anyway, we're all over the map, basically, David.
Okay, well, that's cool, and I respect that. And what I was going to ask you guys is, and this has to do with the issue of illegal immigration, which I find interesting how the dynamic has kind of shifted. If you notice, and this is something I've seen amongst Democrats, they basically adopted this idea of anything Trump supports, you take the opposite position, like by default,
regardless
of the idea itself, right? So what I find interesting is I'm trying to understand why Democrats and progressives have the position on immigration, illegal immigration that they do, which if you go back maybe 20, 30 years ago and you look at, let's say, Cesar Chavez, who was obviously very progressive, very much in the left, who started the United Farm Workers Union in Southern California, and how they fought so vigorously against illegal immigration to the point where they were actually sending vans down there with union members to literally harass and to beat up anyone trying to cross the border illegally into California. And the reason they did that was they felt that illegal immigrants were being brought into California to basically undercut the leverage that the unions had and had negotiated to try to get better wages and benefits for, you know, farm workers at that time. And it's interesting now you fast forward 20 years later and the Democrat Party is wholeheartedly embracing basically open borders and amnesty. And they're willing to sell out the interests of the same workers that they claim to represent. And I'm just trying to understand how this happened and why they've literally given Trump this position to basically guarantee he's going to keep on winning, because immigration is going to keep him in office for the next, you know, the next term as well.
You want to tackle this?
I'm willing to field this as the Democrat in the room. I guess
yeah,
the first thing
Democrat
I would say is that, yeah. Yeah, I have a couple of different points on this. First off, and this has always been my position even from before I kind of became much more left leaning than I am now. But this is really in essence a capitalist perspective or a right wing perspective. If you're worried about immigration into America and you're worried about illegal immigration, don't punish the people who are coming here. The people they need to be punishing are the people who are hiring people illegally. If Trump was truly worried about illegal immigration, he wouldn't care about how many people have come into the country illegally. He would be arresting the people who are paying the people who are here illegally, because if there weren't people hiring illegal aliens, there wouldn't be illegal aliens here. The reason he won't do that is because this gets to the second point I was going to make, which is as much as the conservative party tends to gripe about illegal immigrants, they are typically the ones who are hiring a lot of illegal immigrants. You look at, for example, here in Arkansas, if you're looking for where to find, you know, illegal immigrants, they're typically in big factories. You know, they're in the Tyson chicken mm-hmm. plant. And I guarantee the Tysons are not paying the Clintons any lip service. They get a lot of money going to the conservative party. The reason that they like those people to be illegal is because if you've got somebody who you can pay less money than the prevailing wage, and B, if they complain, you've got a way to immediately kick them out and never have to deal with them again. You've essentially got an indentured labor force, and so I think there's a lot of perverse incentives there. But finally,
it's not a conservative position. This is a progressive position that has evolved into a conservative position because the progressives, for whatever reason, have abandoned their constituency that they claim to represent. That's my point. I'm not arguing in the sense that I'm saying why have the progressives sold out blue collar workers in the hopes of gaining illegal immigrants as potentially new voters through amnesty? That's what we're talking about.
I think what David's asking is rather than arguing, he's not arguing the point, he's asking why the shift from in the past when the Democrats were essentially very pro-labor and were squelching immigration to now where it's the same party that is very much encouraging immigration, whatever you feel.
Okay,
about
can I jump in here for a second?
Yes.
I'd like to jump in here because I think what we're looking at here is a moralistic shift. Okay, now, I had said before, you know, I look at things from a more progressive Christian sense. And you take a look at how, you know, it says in the Bible we're supposed to take in people, the immigrants and the outsiders and things like that. And I think there's been a shift in that sense because if you take a look mm-hmm. at what's happening now with the group that's coming up to the border, you know, they're coming from Honduras and they are immigrants because of violence in their country. And that my former Episcopalian church has a Honduran enclave down there that's been taken over by the government. And so it's a different sense. It's not about workers so much as it is about people that have been displaced by violence, and they are migrants because of their situation. And are we as a country, you know, and that's the way the Democrats think, we're part of the country. How do we react to that? So I don't think it's so much of a worker thing as it is that it's shifted to the inherent violence and the displacement that we see all around us.
Okay, the caravan is. I don't know how you've interpreted that the caravan is somehow just a bunch of displaced people fleeing violence and poverty. The actual facts, you can research this, it's an actual political group that has to do with the fact that in Honduras, you have the former leader deposed by the Supreme Court due to the fact that they believe that he had an illegal election, that he was engaged in corruption, and a more quote-unquote conservative, or what we consider more capitalist, government ruling body is now in place. And so that displaced leader has started this movement in conjunction with the leaders in Venezuela to sponsor this group to send them up there as a political statement. And so this narrative that this caravan is a bunch of poor people fleeing that's not the case at all. Go research who's behind this. Has nothing to do with that.
First off, I would dispute that without some facts to back it up. But more importantly, and the point I was trying to get to, the third leg of my argument, the most important leg, is if you want to both act humanely and at the same time, if you want to support the workers that you're talking about, the best way to do that is to legally have those people here, because at that point, if they're legally here, then you can enforce things like, hey, you're here, that's great. You're not a citizen, you don't get to vote, but you still got to pay taxes because you've got a job in America, and you're paying taxes, you're getting paid a comparable wage to an American worker, so therefore, you know, you're essentially, if you know they're there, then you've got a whole suite of laws you can have them follow. And, yes, so they're not citizens.
Right.
If there wasn't a market for them to be working, they wouldn't be here.
Okay, so what would be the con to your argument then? What would be the negatives to your argument? Because that's the pro argument. So what's the con for the point you're making? Think about it. What are the possible risks if we go about that way? Do what you just said.
To me, I don't see any downside to saying, hey, you're here, make yourself known, be upfront about it. And then at that point, they're no different than an American citizen from the point of view of, yes, it's possible you can have a criminal, but studies if you look at the statistics on this, immigrants are less likely to commit a crime than an American citizen because they know that they are in a position of jeopardy, and so therefore they're going to be more careful because they know they don't have the same protections as a citizen.
Okay, so how many people are you going to grant? Are you going to grant citizenship to, and what's the cutoff point?
I wasn't saying anything about granting citizenship. I'm talking about having them here. Yeah.
Let me jump in here for a second. I think this is a good example of what we're talking about on the show. Is that, for example, I mean, you may have on one side there the Honduras. This is what the Honduras caravan is made up of. Is this group? But then you've got the other side. Oh no! It's a bunch of Islamic terrorists. Each side is putting their favorite interpretation on it, whereas the truth may be somewhere in the middle. And again, I think we're seeing this argument is like the argument seems to be these days either no immigrants or yes immigrants. How? What about maybe the middle ground should be how, not no. How and who? I mean, if an immigrant can come in, pay taxes, be documented. I mean, if they're undocumented immigrants, fine, let's document them. If they can get a job, if they can pay taxes, if they can support themselves, if they don't fuck up, fine. I'm okay with that. If they're supporting themselves, I have no problem with that. Because the issue here is everyone working illegally, so let's get around. Let's provide a legal avenue for these people to come in and get jobs. And if someone does cause problems without the constitutional protections of citizenship, they fuck it up. We can tell them to get out. And it's not perfect, but I kind of feel like that's the middle ground. What were you going to say?
What I'm saying is when you talked about what's the line we draw, the line we draw on almost any American with common sense and reason is illegal versus legal. No one is opposing legal immigration, right? My family immigrated here, and I have family that are in the process of immigrating here. For those who don't know, apparently, unfortunately, a lot of Americans don't even know what the legal process is. It requires nearly a year and a half to 2 years of paperwork and processing, more than, we're talking about a couple thousand dollars in processing fees that have to be paid. And the U.S. Homeland Department and a lot of other departments do an in-depth vetting process and analysis of not only the individual's background, but the likelihood that they'll be able to come here and support themselves or have family to support them. Okay, so the idea that the millions of people that are doing it the legal route, that are doing all the paperwork, that are paying all the fees, and then you allow millions of people to circumvent that entire process, skip ahead of all these people, and just walk into the country who haven't been vetted whatsoever at all. You don't know if they're criminal or not. You don't know what they are. And the fact that you're just going with that, just off of an emotional plea of compassion, is illogical, and it makes no sense. There's no way you should run a country off of emotionalism. That's ridiculous. Our country should be run off of a logical, rational thought. I
can't
understand why
that's difficult. I agree we can't give full rein to our just – I mean, I am a compassionate person, but I also understand that there has to be – I think we have to find a balance between approaching this compassionately and approaching this from purely logic. It's almost like the whole Kirk versus Spock thing. How do we balance our humanity and our passion with our reason? And I think there's a middle ground, and I think, again, we're not finding it right now. And I don't have a perfect answer because I'm open-minded.
Our current legal immigration process is that middle ground you're referring to. America brings in nearly a million immigrants a year. The vast majority of them happen to be from third world countries. That's the reality. And the idea that America somehow not compassionate because all of a sudden – we are somehow opposing legal immigration. That's a ridiculous slander of this country. America's probably the most compassionate and giving country on the planet when it comes to not only bringing people in, but it comes to humanitarian efforts worldwide. I know this firsthand. Okay. Someone who served in the military and was in part of a lot of humanitarian efforts in all parts of the world, and not to mention the foreign aid that the U.S. government gives to many of these countries, which is the only reason these countries even have governments to begin with, like Honduras, basically depends on US foreign aid even to exist. So you
it is important
to our country as if we're lacking compassion. I find that absolutely ridiculous.
Well, I think it's important to remember here, and this is something, this is just from a historical point of view. You're talking about legal and illegal. Historically, there was no such thing as an illegal immigrant before about, I'm double checking my numbers here, the Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. And at that point, the only people who were illegal were Chinese because we decided we didn't want Chinese people here. The legal and illegal immigrant thing is something that is it's a creation of basically the last 150 years in America. Previous to that and previous to most of history, immigration was you came into a country, you said, hey, I'm here, I'm going to get a job and pay tax. And so I think the you're talking about, is it fair to all the people going through the paperwork to come here illegally? What I'm telling you is I don't think it's fair to make them do that paperwork. I think if they come here, they say they're here to work, they're doing the job, it shouldn't be a matter of, well, you know, have we decided we've let in enough people from Ghana this year? It doesn't matter where you came from. It's are you here? Are you working? Are you following? Are you contributing to society? And I think to basically turn into an exercise of oh well, you haven't filed your form what the fuck ever is ridiculous.
Well, this is an example where too much bureaucracy gets in the way.
That's what the paperwork is there to determine, to vet, to want to know who this person is. Do they have a criminal background? Are they going to come here to work? What are their intentions? That's what the whole process is for. Otherwise, let's just take what you're even implying at face value. Let's just say anyone who made it across the border, you're free to enter. It's all good, whatever. You have no idea who that person is. And as someone who has family that live in Texas, if you don't know that there's a lot of drug cartels and gang activity that comes up from Mexico and Central America into the United States, and to act like that doesn't exist, but that's not a real issue, is to me that's the height of naivety, man. I mean, how do you live that way? How can you run a country that way? I mean, think about what you're saying.
We're getting toward the end of the show. Let me address this, and then we're gonna have to wrap up. I think this is a good example of where too much, and this isn't a libertarian speaking, this is where an example of there's too much bureaucracy is a problem. Because I understand that, yes, paperwork is designed to try to vet people to make sure things are okay. But, I mean, look again, that you're piling on bureaucracy and paperwork and this and that and everything else. And as far as illegal drug cartels, well, if we had a policy of legalizing and regulating drugs, you would cut the legs off from underneath the cartels. But I think this is
you're
going to
legalize
where,
cocaine and heroin?
You'd have to find a balance. I don't know. I don't have a perfect answer, but I'm saying I lean towards legalization of drugs.
Oh, my goodness, man. I mean, come on. I mean, are your ideas practical? But, I mean, be honest. The idea of legalizing cocaine and heroin, I mean, legalizing marijuana is one thing, but cocaine and heroin, I mean, you would want that to be legalized?
I think we can be more towards the middle than we are now, and I don't have a perfect answer. I don't claim hard line one side or the other. I see a lot of gray areas, and I'm not a politician or a lawmaker. The best I can do is offer the opinion, and it's completely possible that I'm wrong. It's always possible that anybody's wrong. But anyway, we're near the end of the show, so I've got to cut this off and ask any of my co-hosts here if they have any final thoughts.
Okay, but before he leaves, please,
yes.
I just wanted to say I didn't really say much about the immigration. I have some people here. I will just say this, that the vetting process that the U.S. government needs to be rethought because it takes a lot more than a year and a half these days, trust me, to go through. But that being said, I just wanted to thank our caller for calling in. And please say your name again. And please introduce yourself again, because that was a really good conversation, and I thank you for that.
Yes, sir. My name's David, and I'm sorry for getting contentious with some of you guys.
No, not at all.
We're having a healthy debate.
Right, exactly. This is why we want to do these shows, because we want people to be able to talk and to see different sides, and it's as I said at the beginning, we need to listen to each other. So again, I sincerely say thank you very much, David, for calling in. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate you calling in.
Absolutely, and for all that I may disagree with you, I am perfectly happy to. It was nice to have that conversation with you and to be able to have it civilly.
Yes,
exactly. That's the whole point.
Perfect capper to this.
That's the whole point.
Show is being able to have conversations like this instead of devising this for people to have opposing viewpoints to be able to come to the middle and at least try to sort things out instead of just turning into a pissing contest.
Thanks very much for calling, David.
Perfect climax of the show,
thank you.
David. Thanks again. And feel free to call back next time.
Yes, sir. You guys have a good night.
You too.
You too.
That was great. That was fantastic.
That was fucking fantastic, David.
I'm very pleased.
Yes!
My. This is one thing that makes radio fun.
Well, we are
about 5 minutes away from being over with. I know the magic voice, the mysterious voice, is going to pop in here in a minute and tell us we're running out of time. So I know
actually,
you wanted to plug your...
The magic voice is going to tell you, you guys were doing really awesome. I'm glad David called in, and that was quite a great, very good show, guys. I applaud very much.
Thank you. Our producer likes this, too. Damn.
That's right.
Well done, guys. Well done.
All right. I believe you wanted to plug your show one more time, Carl, the one you got coming up on religion.
Yeah, okay. Right now we have a couple shows on the network, on the Deviant Legion network. On Saturday, Vicky Love is going to do her first show, Driving Backward in Fog. And I will be on with her and Doc and hopefully Joey Vento. We'll be talking about Godzilla and various things.
Ooh,
so that's just a lot of fun. Gojira! And on Sunday, this Sunday, which is the 4th, I will be hosting the first ever visit to the sanatorium. And the sanatorium is a Facebook group that I'm involved with. And it's going to be a humor show. And it's going to be lots of fun. And hopefully what I want to do, and they don't know this yet, is as we go on with this series, to have some comics on there. So I've actually got a couple that I'm working on right now. But this is our introductory show. We're going to have Alan Davis, who is the admin there, and a couple of our favorite inmates, and that would be Frederick Crox and also Peggy Roach, who I swear to God I need to take you out to Denny's again. On the 11th, I don't have a name for the show. Well, actually, I do. It's going to be called Carl's Cavern. That's going to be my regular show. And the first show is going to be with Pastor Joel Biggers. And we're going to be talking about Christian films and our reaction to them on different ones. And he is a UCC pastor, and I'm an Episcopalian. We're both on the liberal side, and we're going to be talking about that sense of it compared to some films like Calvary and First Reformed. That should be a lot of fun, too, and hopefully we'll get some callers in like our caller tonight.
But that's what we've got so far right now planned
for the Deviant Legion.
Yes,
go ahead.
I'm working on another episode of the Sludge Pit that live we were talking our first show had a little bit of a malfunction with, but that was we were talking about broadcast television before it went digital and all the weird little things you'd see, and we're currently working on a show about live action oddities, like weird different strange shows like H.R. Puff and stuff and the Croft Brothers and. We have a little bit of an issue going on with, I hate to say it, but Blog Talk. I've been waiting for close to a week and a half on reply on whether or not we can do two shows in one day. So hopefully it's either going to be this Sunday or next Sunday. We will have another episode of the Sludge Pit. Everybody's invited, and we are going to be talking some weird stuff that we saw on TV when we were kids. Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And as for this show, we're going to be back next week with another titillating topic. I'm not going to tell you what it is. We do plan on having a calendar of events up soon, but for the time being, you listeners are going to have to stay in suspense from week to week until we get that ironed out. I would especially say welcome, Nicodemus. I'm super glad we added you to the group. You're definitely a welcome contribution to this. You have a lot to say, and you're good at saying it, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure to jump into the podcast field with you, sir.
Well, you're one of us now, and we're like the mafia. You never can get back out again.
One of us! One of us! He's one of us!
He is one of us. Don't put on the sunglasses. Stay away, Ripper. My bad.
And another thing is, don't drink the Kool-Aid.
I came here to kick ass and chew bubble gum.
Awesome.
And podcast.
Your podcast and chew bubble gum. Yeah, okay. And you're all out of bubble gum. All right. Well, everybody say goodnight.
Good night.
Thanks for joining us.
Gracie.
It was fun. See y'all next week.
Good night, George.
Good night.
Bye.